So in the Buddha talked about avoiding the two extremes. Of course, typically in real life, what we actually do is bounce around between the two extremes for most of our time, and then kind of accidentally stumble across the middle way one day, and then realize, oh, okay, that's it, that's what the Buddha was on about. So the time leading up to the rains retreat, there's been a bit of busyness, a bit of hectic organizing things and so on. Everyone's been doing a lot of work contributing to the monastery and the growth of the community, and focusing on that aspect of our practice and our spiritual life, not just helping the people here but also helping the broader Buddhist community. And I'm very proud of the contribution that Santi's made to the ASA conference, to the Mitra conference, to the Buddhist community in Sydney. We make a contribution through our online presence, which inspires many people. I get many emails and contacts from people who've found out about us through the website. All of these kinds of things, and these are all good. You know, people, they make a difference in people's lives. Please never doubt that. The things that we're doing here really make a difference in people's lives. They're very genuine. Both for everybody sitting here, the experience at Santi Monastery has influenced and affected all of us very greatly. But even people outside, people who you maybe see occasionally if they come to Bringdana, or maybe you don't see them at all. They never come to Bringdana. Maybe you only see them occasionally in Sydney. Or people who are on the internet somewhere, somewhere on the other side of the world. And they see something, make contact with what we're doing here and find some inspiration and some solace from what's happening. This is what's part of what it means to be a Buddhist monastic. This is not a new innovation at all. The means by which we do it is new, but the idea is a very long-standing one. Remember that, just as one example, in the Chula Gosinga Sutta, the Buddha said that if people were to recollect the good practice of the three monks, the three friends living in the Gosinga wood forest, and that if they were because they were practicing in such harmony, in such concord, and putting so much effort in to really practicing to realize the Dhamma, and if only people would recognize that and respect that for what it was, then this would be a great benefit for them. So this is something which each of you contributes to, and please never forget that. Never forget that, even though you know, when you come here, you know, you maybe feel that, you know, what you're doing is very small or not significant, and you know, you're just one member of a team, and you know, the monastery was here before you came here, and it'll probably be here after you've gone. But while you're here, you're part of that, and you're part of contributing to that wider spiritual energy which is being manifested through this place, and which affects and influences so many people's lives for the good. So this is something which should be a recollection for all of us, and a source for mudita, and a source for joy, for rejoicing for all of us. This is the difference between the kind of real Dhamma that we're practicing here, with the authenticity of the Dhamma that we practice, and the kind of Dhamma which you could, in a perhaps a slightly cynical mood, call the narcissistic Dhamma, which is practiced in a lot of modern schools of Dhamma, where, you know, people say, for example, pay to go on a retreat, and you have a bunch of people paying to go and sit on a retreat, and it doesn't bring about that same kind of communal rejoicing and communal spirit that what we're doing here does. It's about individuals who manage to scrape together enough cash to pay for their own board and lodging and facilities so that they can do their own retreat. And the way we do things is completely different from that. It's completely, totally different. It's based entirely on dana and entirely on donations. And so we freely accept whatever's given, we use what's given carefully and mindfully, and we try to take that and use it in our practice. So please remember, during the rains retreat, lots of people have offered so much in terms of giving the dana for the food in the rains retreat. Every time that we eat a meal, we should remember that, remind ourselves that this is something which has been given, freely given. Everything that we eat comes from donations. In this world which is so riven and tormented by greed, and we saw the presentations on the last week about consumerism, and how Buddhism could be an antidote to consumerism. Well, this is what we're doing here. We are the antidote to consumerism, or an antidote to consumerism. We've seen how destructive that modern Western lifestyle is for the environment, yeah? And we are living that change. We are living in a way that's very simple, very energy conscious, and all of those things, that we're living in a way which is a great example for living in harmony with the environment. And we see so much conflict in the world, and that's caused by, among other things, by religion and ideology. And so here we try to live peacefully. We work harmoniously with people from different beliefs. We work. We try to help people regardless of what their beliefs are and their background and so on. And so we try to set an example of harmony in a world which is riven by conflict and strife. So all these are very beautiful things, very powerful things, which form the environment of our community. Which we sometimes can forget. We begin to take it for granted, and we forget how rare it is, how precious it is, how unique it is to be able to do this kind of thing. And I mentioned earlier that the three things that I want to base this community on: one is the practice of Vinaya, to build a community according to Vinaya, and this is something that we have paid a lot of attention to and given a lot of care to over the past year and in previous years as well. We've had a lot of Vinaya classes, we've had a lot of interest in it, we've had a lot of discussions. People have seen the strength and the importance of practicing in accordance with Vinaya. Hopefully we try to use Vinaya in the proper way, the best way that we can. A way that's neither too rigid and literal, but then yet is not too too kind of wishy-washy. So we try to hit that again, that elusive middle ground in interpreting Vinaya, and remembering that one of the main part of the purpose of Vinaya is to restrain us from doing what is bad. And when we had the teaching on the eight precepts just now, that's what. That aspect of Vinaya was the eight precepts that you learned there are essentially the backbone of the kind of the ascetic life of Buddhism, with the addition, of course, of the refraining from using money when one takes the Samanera or Samaneri precepts. But apart from that, that's the backbone of not only which is considered to be the essential moral precepts. Remember that the silas, the precepts, partly include moral injunctions, not to kill, not to steal, not to lie, yeah, and partly things which are purely conventional. They're not things which are wrong in and of themselves. So eating in the afternoon is not something which is wrong in and of itself. It's not an unwholesome act. You know, going to shows and wearing beads and things like that are not things which are wrong. They're not harmful by themselves. Using a big bed is not something which is harmful or damaging. But these are ascetic precepts, mild ascetic precepts, which are intended to cultivate a life of simplicity. Okay? And so they're things which are not wrong in themselves, but there are things which become wrong if we have taken up the precept. Okay? So we've got that convention, we live in a community under agreement with each other about keeping these precepts. Okay? And so it becomes wrong to violate them after we've undertaken them, not beforehand. So it is important to pay attention to these. Don't break the precepts. If you do break any of the precepts, then understand why, reflect on it, and be sure not to do it again. If you are unsure or feel guilty about it or feel a sense of remorse over your precepts, then please come and see myself or one of the ayahs to discuss this, okay? Talk about you know, what you feel uncertain about the precept. You may have broken it, you're not sure, or you feel a sense of remorse or something like that. Okay, if it's just something small that you break a precept, you know, say you're eating one time and you know it happens to be a bit late or something in the afternoon. Okay, it's and after the literal noon time or something like that, then that's not such a big deal, and then you can just determine not to do it again and get on with life. There's nothing complicated or uncertain about that. On the other hand, some precepts might be quite dubious. For example, a precept about lying. You might be unsure, you might have said something which may have been misleading or something, and you may be unsure whether you've broken the precept on lying. So sometimes it's good to seek out some advice about that. And particularly the precept on sexual misconduct is also a very important one. Literally, the precept means not to have sexual intercourse. Okay, so if you want to define it literally, and as it's defined literally in the Theravadan tradition, Abrahamacharya means not to have sexual intercourse. But of course the precept needs to be interpreted more widely than that, and the way we understand it is that it means there's no sexual conduct at all, including masturbation or making out or anything like that. Okay, so it doesn't mean that you can't have any physical contact with somebody of the opposite sex. So some people say that once you've taken the eight precepts, you know, people say, oh, I'm going to take the eight precepts, but then I can't, you know, hug my daughter or something like that. No, that's not what it means. Okay, so ordinary physical contact is fine. Actually, even in the Parimokkha precepts, there's nothing against ordinary physical contact between men and women. It's only specifically sexually motivated contact, which is actually against the Vinaya. So also to be just circumspect and careful in these things, and remember that in regard to these rules in particular, regarding sexual conduct, there's always three persons to be considered. One is oneself, second is the other person, and the third is anybody who may be onlooking, okay, or anybody else who might know what's going on. So please consider all those things. If you're not sure what you're doing is appropriate, then best to try to refrain act with as much discretion as you can. So keeping those precepts, the eight precepts, ten precepts, the bhikkhuni precepts, we're practicing those factors of the Eightfold Path that we recited in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. So especially the factors of right speech, right action, and right livelihoods covered indirectly, but mainly right speech and right action. So when the Buddha taught this Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, he meant something specific by it. When he said practice the middle way, he didn't just sort of use it as a vague philosophical term which didn't have any content. Okay, and so this is something that's important to remember, and that sometimes Buddhism is taught as if it's a kind of a liberal philosophy where everything goes, and as long as you don't hurt anybody and everything's empty, and then that's just great, you know. So sometimes it doesn't have much more content than that. But the way the Buddha presented it, these things had a specific meaning. He wanted us to actually act in certain ways, to do certain kinds of things. So practice of right view, and practicing of right view is what you're doing here, listening to the Dhamma, talking about the Dhamma, reading, studying the suttas. This is essentially how we and reflecting in oneself about the meaning of these things, reflecting, questioning one's own views, and so on and so forth. This is basically how we practice right view. Right intention, what are our motivations? How do we use our mind, and how does that manifest in our activities of body and speech? Do we act out of a way which is greedy and grasping, out of a way which is angry and vengeful, or do we act out of kindness and out of letting go, out of wanting to help? So this is that the way that the mind is moved. How do we use our mind? This is the right thought or right intention of the Eightfold Path. Right speech is covered briefly in the precepts under to refrain from false speech, but as I've emphasized again and again and again, the Buddha said that precept on speech should be used positively. So on speaking at the right time, speaking what is good, what is beneficial, what is relating to the Dhamma and the Vinaya, speaking words which reconcile those who are divided, words which can go into the heart, pleasing to the ear, dear and beloved to the many folk, words which are meaningful. So this is the kind of speech which we should be using. So right speech is not just an absence of speech. So we all have a responsibility to develop this. Okay? So don't think that being part of a monastic community simply means shutting up and not saying anything. You need to actually learn and put effort into learning to be articulate and clear in your speech, to be able to communicate effectively to people. Okay, that means not in a confused and rambling and illogical way that people no one can understand. It means not in a kind of a mumbling way that people can't hear properly. It means not being afraid to say things that need to be said. It means not saying lots of things that don't need to be said. So this is the practice of right speech. Now for the next 2 weeks we're going to be practicing what they call noble silence, and I'll be saying a few more words about that later on, but I'll just say for now that noble silence is an extremely two-edged tool, and it's not without a great deal of reserve and trepidation that I kind of suggested this and supported the practice of noble silence for 2 weeks. Actually, we shouldn't really think of it as being strictly keeping silence, because I said we can always say please and thank you, alright? And also if there's something that needs to be said, please say it, okay? The important thing is always check and check again. Does it really need to be said? Not to be blurting out with all kinds of crap all the time. And the extraordinary thing is that you learn through practicing this silence, is you learn to see that the rising of that, what they call the vachi sankhara, the rising of that energy within our mind that moves towards making a speech. You can actually see it, you can feel that energy coming up in your belly and then moving towards your mouth. You feel that, and then you don't say it. And then it just goes away, it subsides. And then you realize, actually there was no need to be saying that. There was no need for me to be imposing my consciousness on somebody else. Now remember, that's what that right speech is. We had the factors of the path, right view, right intention, sankhapa. This is the direction, the movement of the mind, and then the next factor is right speech. So right speech is expressing your thought or your intention or your wishes. So when we speak, we are literally transferring a part of our own mind into the brain of other people. As this is happening right as we're sitting here, I have certain patterns in my mind which correspond with certain patterns in my brain. They form electrical and chemical impulses that shape the movement of my lungs, my larynx, my mouth and tongue, and creates these sounds. The sounds then create an energy pattern in the air, the sound waves in the air. They hit your eardrum, vibrate it, get turned into electrical impulses again, then go into your brain, and then you hear it, and you hear a sound, and it has a meaning to you, and it's been injected mainline straight from my brain into yours. It's creepy, isn't it? So this is, you have to be careful when you're speaking. This is what you're doing. You're mainlining your consciousness into somebody else's brain, right? So you have to be very circumspect about that. What kind of crap are you injecting into somebody else's head? Right, so this is why we try to practice great practice of restraint in speech. So right speech, and then the next precept is refraining from alcohol and drugs and things like that. Well, you won't get much of that around here except for the occasional mushroom. So stay off the shrooms, boys and girls, and not too much of the cough syrup or anything like that, okay? So we're here to develop mindfulness, and these things lead to the ending of mindfulness. Of course, coffee don't, just the opposite. So, kala bhojana, refraining from eating at the wrong time, and I think you all have a good understanding of that precept. It's quite straightforward. And then the Nacha Gita and song singing and dancing and so on, then again that one's pretty straightforward. About sense restraint and simplicity. And avoiding high and luxurious beds and seats, and again you won't have much chance in this monastery to indulge in high and luxurious beds and seats, so that one shouldn't be too difficult. So keeping the precepts when you are in a community like this and in a monastery like this is not a big deal. It's not too hard. We all support each other, we all help each other, and keeping the precepts for most of us is not too bad. Some people sometimes get tempted to nibble something in the afternoon or something like that, but please don't. If you take food, by the way, in the afternoon, which is not offered, you're, as well as eating in the afternoon, you're also taking what is not given. The food in the kitchen is not yours to be taken. So that's two precepts at once. And if you fib about it afterwards, it's three. So Now for the next period of time we're going to be on intensive retreat, and I wanted to talk a little bit about this before we go on with the intensive retreat. And I mentioned earlier that I again, just like the noble silence idea, I also have great trepidation and reservations about the idea of doing intensive retreat. Okay, it's not something which we've done before yet. It's an experiment, and so we see how it works. All right. Rule number one: don't go crazy. All right. No going crazy on the retreat. If you do, you'll be in big trouble. So if you feel like your mind is slipping or whatever, and we know that it's happened before here, that please just stop meditating, go and have a sleep. All right. This is the antidote of the Thai forest tradition. Go and sleep. Okay. And come and talk to somebody. Okay. So please, if you feel, you know, if you feel really unbalanced or your mind's starting to come apart or whatever, find me or somebody else and talk to them. Okay? Talking is a great mediator of the mind. It tends to bring us back and ground us and make us more settled, more centered. So please talk, and please sleep if there's any, if you feel the mind is getting loose. Now when we're doing that, the intensive retreat, we have a schedule. Did we get around to writing the schedule on the board?
There is a schedule on the board with interviews, which I've been meaning to say. It's there from yesterday.
Okay, terrific. Thank you for that.
Yeah, just the interviews done.
Okay, so that's all on the board. Now, the retreat schedule that we've set up is pretty tough. Okay, 12 hours a day of meditation is not a small amount. It's a lot of meditation. And many of you have done this kind of retreat before, or this level of meditation before. Some of you haven't, so we just do it and see. Okay, so nobody's going to be you know, beating any sticks. No one's going to be hitting you in the retreat unless you really, really need it. So please try to come for all of the sessions, okay? And please try to stay through all the sessions. But if you can't, or if you feel really stressed, or you're too tired, or you feel sick, or whatever, then just stay away, have a nice rest, okay? Upeka has already said, because she's had a bit of a flu and so on, that she maybe practiced somewhere else so she doesn't cough and so on while she's around people. So if you see people who are absent, then if you suspect that they may be ill, then go to them and see what's wrong. Especially, you know, look after the people who are, you know, like the monks look after the monks, the nuns look after the nuns, the anagarikas look after the other anagarikas, lay people look after lay people. Okay, so if you see somebody who's one of your friends there, normally sitting next to you, and then they're not there, and you're not sure why, just check up on them, make sure that they're okay. All right. In the intensive retreat period, it's good to not try to do anything else too much. By anything else, I mean don't try to do too much other ascetic practices. You're already doing a lot of meditation, and that's going to be pretty tough for all of us. So don't try to, you know, think I'm going to halve the amount I'm going to eat, or I'm going to just eat two spoons of rice a day or something like that, the silly things that monks do sometimes. And don't quit coffee. Absolutely. If you've been drinking coffee every day and then you quit, you'll be tired and headachy and in a bad mood for the first third of your retreat. So this is one rule with retreats. If you want to go off coffee, go off at 2 weeks before the start of the retreat, not actually on the retreat itself. And also I'd prefer it if people didn't fast during the retreat, again, because that can encourage the mind to just become to spin out a bit more. Okay, so if you really feel like cutting down on food on retreat, I don't know if anybody does, and it's pretty cold, so maybe it's not going to be that popular here, but at least please, you would make me a lot happier if you'd at least have a couple of Weet-Bix in the morning, just to sort of settle you down a bit. Okay. So the important thing when we're actually doing the retreat, we're sitting there together, and as I said before, half in jest, but only half in jest, is to make this an annoyance retreat instead of a meditation retreat. So if we think we're going to get there, you see, this is one of the problems on lay people's retreats, is that it's so hard for them to find time to practice, get time off work, time off family, and all of these things, and they come along and they've got so much invested in this particular weekend or this week, and then they feel very disappointed if they feel like they haven't got anywhere with their meditation, and so of course the tension and the nervousness around that doesn't help. So let's not worry about that. We have the 3 months of the Rains Retreat ahead of us, plenty of time for meditation, so don't worry too much about the retreat. Just treat it playfully. Okay, so we have a play retreat. Just have like a mess around retreat. And by messing around, I don't mean literally messing around, but just having that kind of attitude. It's not, as I said before, I personally don't like doing retreats, sitting in a room with a group of people all the time. I much prefer, and I always have better meditation if I'm by myself, but we just kind of do that, and there'll be noises, people moving in the room, opening and closing the door, there'll be the noises from downstairs, the cars driving in the driveway, and all of these things. So just deal with it, right? It's not a big deal, okay? It's just a bit of noise. It's not, you know, even though I'm as aware and as sensitive as anyone to having a bit of noise around, I don't think it's the case that anybody in this monastery has seriously any issue with the noise affecting their meditation or their spiritual practice. It's almost impossible to find anywhere, including some very remote hermitages like Phujongkhom. It's almost impossible to find anywhere in Thailand today which is as quiet as this monastery. And certainly Bodhinyana is much noisier, certainly Bodhiwana is much noisier, certainly Wat Nanachat is extremely noisier. So this is very, very lucky to be able to have a place like this which is so quiet and so conducive to meditation. So when we practice, I would recommend having a balance of sitting and walking meditation. Don't just sit unless you're just very comfortable sitting. If you're very comfortable to keep sitting, just do that. But it's generally better to intersperse the sitting meditation with walking meditation. If you're very tired, then do fairly short sits. Okay, so do maybe half an hour sitting, half an hour walking, and so on, and swapping backwards and forwards. There's no point in forcing yourself to sit for long periods of time if your meditation is not there. If your mind isn't carrying you through that time, okay? So unlike the meditation instructions that we heard the other day of making people sit for longer so that they can experience more pain, no, that's not what we do here, alright? It's not what the Buddha taught. You sit longer if it's contributing to developing your concentration. That's all. When the mind becomes peaceful and settled and you're naturally content, and then you allow yourself to sit longer just to allow the mind to follow its meditation and go deeper and deeper into the meditation. That's why we sit for long periods of time. Not because we want to feel pain, not because we're trying to outdo the person next to us or beat some kind of record or anything like that. Only sit for as long as your meditation actually lasts for. And so this is something which you just have to get used to and get a kind of sensitivity towards how long the meditation's gone. When you feel like the time's finished, then be mindful. You note to yourself, okay, that meditation's gone. Reflect, as I teach when I do the guided meditations each time, I reflect at the end of the meditation, what was that like? Okay, how was that going? Okay, that's what that was like. Okay, now, and then you determine, okay, now I'm going to get up, I'm going to do some walking meditation. And so you get up and go and do some walking meditation, okay? Just as a matter of etiquette, while I think of it, don't be doing yoga and stretching and things like that in the meditation hall. Okay, it's okay to do just a gentle stretch of your legs, or you know, stick your legs out and you know, something like that, and just relieve your legs or something. But nothing more energetic than that. Okay, don't want to see people getting up there in the morning and doing push-ups or something like that. You may be laughing about it, but people would do that at Nanachat or whatever. So please, if you want to do some yoga, it's a very good idea to do that. I'm not discouraging doing it. Do some yoga, some Tai Chi, whatever. And please do it downstairs before you come up to sit, not in the meditation hall. When we're meditating for long periods every day, focus. Remember what your essential meditation is, and focus and be clear about that. Okay, don't be all kind of woofly and vague about your meditation. Okay, know what am I doing here? Am I doing anapanasati? If you're doing breath meditation, watch your breath. Don't do anything else. If you're doing metta, then do the metta meditation. Do it well. Do it carefully. Bring a sense of craftsmanship to it. Be an expert. Okay. Get an A+ for it. Okay. You can't determine what is the outcome of your meditation, right? But what you can affect is the care and the quality with which you apply yourself. All right. And if you apply yourself with care each time, then you'll see the results. If you're usually the two extremes that people get into is either being too forceful, pushing too hard, or being too sloppy and too lazy, not caring enough about their meditation, just sort of using it as a chance to just sit there and wait until the period of time is up. So neither of these are the middle way. So the middle way is bringing that sense of care and devotion to your meditation. Each breath is something beautiful. Each breath is something very precious. Each breath is something which is your vehicle to Nibbana. So never forget this. This is why we're practicing. We're practicing because this is the Eightfold Path. This is the culmination of that. We've done the right view, the right intention, the right speech, right action, right livelihood. And now we're actually there, we're sitting, we're putting forth the effort to be awake, be in the meditation hall. Yeah, that's the right energy. We're practicing mindfulness, we're bringing awareness again and again and again and again and again and again to the object of meditation, to our body posture, to what's going on in the present moment. It's our practice of right mindfulness. And with a bit of luck, then that will lead to right samadhi, to the practice of jhanas, or to the realization of jhanas. So these things are basically how you get enlightened. There's no mystery about it. There's no real controversy about it, honestly. I mean, we spend ages discussing all of these different things and different interpretations of meditation and philosophy and blah, 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 blah. But the reality is that the path is very clear and very straightforward, and the real problem is lack of doing. So it's our job to be doing that path, okay, putting forth the effort. All of that work which you've done in the last months, all of that is leading up to this. Okay, we've all been working very, very hard and in a very balanced way to build this community. And I'm very, very proud of what everybody here has done. I'm so proud to feel that we as a community have managed to build this community, to put it all up. Everybody doing their bit. Some people offering the donations, some people helping run the monastery, do the administration, some people helping physically to work on the land. Some people helping with the teaching, other people simply setting a great example of silence and restraint and meditation, dedication to meditation. All of these things are adding to the community, and all of them are part of who we are, what we're doing here at Santi Frost Monastery. So I really want to see you guys all get enlightened this retreat. I want you to be coming to me in the interviews and saying, "Bhante, I got into this state of mind, it was so amazing, it was like this and like that," so that I can confidently say to you, "Yes, that's second jhana, yes, that's fourth jhana. Now you're ready to develop those deep insights," and then to see you come back in subsequent weeks and saying, "Bhante, the world exploded yesterday. Everything is different. A part of me has disappeared. And the strange part is that I never even knew that that part of me existed in the first place. All I know is that it's gone. And when I hear people coming to me with these kinds of levels of insight and realization, then I'll be able to feel that this monastery is really truly bearing its fruits. We saw at the ASA conference last Thursday that the question was raised yet again of how difficult it is for many Sangha members to find support for their practice, and how people, even a very intelligent and charismatic teacher like Karma Lekche Somo, is not able to just live off donations for what she does, but has to work professionally in order to support herself. Well, we're not in that situation. We can't complain about that. We have a truly magnificent monastery here. We have very good facilities. We have very healthy food. It's not like in many countries where, we heard so many of the stories of the monks or the lay people have gone to places like Burma to practice and they end up just doing their health in after a few weeks or a few months because the food's so bad. So that hasn't been a problem here. The food is really wonderful. It's very healthy. And the main difficulty or the main thing we have to struggle with physically, of course, is the cold. Yeah, this at the moment is midwinter. It's a bit of a cold snap. This is as cold as it gets. Usually, maybe one or two nights get colder, but generally speaking, this is as cold as it gets. And from now on, it's going to be warming up. Within a few weeks, we will start to notice that the springtime is starting to happen. Okay, and we'll start by halfway through the rains retreat, we'll be starting to feel that it's starting to warm up again. So don't worry too much about the cold. If you've put up with it so far, the rest of it won't be any more difficult than this. But having a bit of physical discomfort is okay to remind ourselves of those practices of contentment and patience and all of those kinds of things. So apart from that physical challenge which all of us face from the cold, most of the things that we have here are good, and we have good dhamma, good teachings. We have a good community to support. We have guidance in meditation. We have seclusion and solitude. We have quiet. All of those things which are really necessary for practice. And so if we want to just get on with what we're doing, get on with our practice to enlightenment, there's nothing to stop us. Okay, there's nothing that holds us back. When I look back at my own life as a monk for the last 15, 16 years, and I look at what were the things that held me back. And I've done many different things, as you know, and I've lived in many different environments, and I've lived in big, busy monasteries and been a lot involved in doing things, and I've lived by myself in seclusion where I haven't done anything at all for years at a time, and so on and so forth. And if I have to say, what is the thing that, why aren't I an arahant, then the answer is very simple. It's because of my own stupidity. It's not because of anybody else. It's not because of the conditions. It's not because of where I've been or anything like that. It's my own ignorance, my own stupidity, my own defilements, which have been the things that have held me back in practice. And ever since I came to the monastery at Wat Nanachat, and even before that, when I was in the monastery at Wat Rampurng, that for some reason I seem to have had the good, is it good karma? I don't know. Good luck, good fortune, whatever, good experience of having the ability and the support to be able to practice and to develop in a good way. And so I tried when I was a young monk at Wat Nanachat. I really tried, to do the best that I could. I really put a lot of effort to finding out, what are my duties, what am I supposed to be doing, how am I supposed to be looking after the teachers, how am I supposed to be cleaning what I'm doing, how am I supposed to be looking after my robes, how am I supposed to be looking after my bowl, how am I supposed to be looking after my kuti. And I put a lot of effort to find out about all those things. Okay, I didn't assume that it was somebody else's job to tell me. I assumed that it was my job to find out what about all these things, and to put a lot of effort into each one of those areas as best that I could. I made a determination that I would not walk past a piece of rubbish in the monastery. And one time when I walked past a lolly wrapper, and there was this thing in my mind that said, I just can't be bothered now. And I went back to my kutia, sat meditation, then I thought of that lolly wrapper. So I got out of my meditation and I walked back right to the other side of the monastery, Wat Nanachat, to find that lolly wrapper again, pick it up and put it in the bin. When I was the storeman, I made a determination that I would never keep anything, I would never, if anybody asked for anything, if we didn't have it in stores, then I would find it for somebody. And if it was the only place I could find it was from my own possessions, then I would just give from my own possessions. So I guess how I practiced as the storeman. And when people asked for a watch, if there wasn't a watch there, I'd give them my watch. If they asked for a particular kind of robe, if there wasn't any in the stores, I'd give it from my own robe. So that's how I practiced when I was a young monk. So I'm just giving you some examples and trying to encourage you to really apply yourself to this practice. Please don't take it for granted. Please do everything that you can to really do this practice. Remember that you don't have to be looking outside. You don't have to be trying to do extra things. Sometimes during the rains retreat, people like to do all kinds of special dutanga or ascetic practices and things like that. And those things are fine if they have a purpose. But only do them if you have a specific reason for it. If you know, for example, I'm really attached to eating lots of sweets. And when I look at the bowl that I take and I look at other people's bowls, I realize I take twice as many sweets as anybody else. And you realize that's just my greed. So for the rains retreat, I won't take any sweets. Okay? You have a specific reason for doing it, specifically counter a defilement. And so then we can do the ascetic practices for that kind of reason. But if you're just doing it out of restlessness, out of trying to push, out of just trying to find something to do, to give yourself a hard time, then that's just a waste of time. That just becomes self-torment, Atthakila Matanu Yoga. It's a complete waste of time. That's not just me speaking. This is what I was told by Lompo Panyawada, the vice abbot of Ajahn Mahabua's monastery. And when a bunch of the young Western monks went to see him, this is specifically, he made the point of mentioning this. If you try to do Dutanga practices and you don't have a specific reason for doing that specific practice, you're wasting your time. Okay? And by wasting your time, it means you're not watching and not focusing attention on those things which are really doing the work. And so this is when it comes down to the essence of going forth, of why one goes forth. And in the suttas, when it talks about going forth, it always says sadha papajito, one who's gone forth out of faith, and one who's gone forth out of faith. And so this is what that going forth is about. And the foremost in going forth out of faith, of course, was Ratnapala. Yeah, his parents objected to him going forth, and he just lay on the ground and said he would stay and lie there until he died. And that's how he persuaded his parents to let him, give him the permission to go forth. So this is that faith. If we don't have that faith, then we're not going to last for very long. We have to have that faith in what we're doing. This is the lifestyle that the Buddha taught. That's why we study the suttas. Okay? That's why we study the Vinaya. Because in those texts, we find out the information that we need about what the Buddha actually taught, and not all the rubbish which is put around him and which is attributed to him. The real stuff. That's why we do this. That's why I spend so much time studying the Pali and all of the comparative studies and all of those kinds of things. It's not because I just sort of get off on doing textual studies for the sake of it. There's a purpose for it. And if you look at all of the very detailed research that I've done over the last few years, you'll see that every book that I've done, every piece of research has a specific reason for it. I'm not a scholar who just does things just for the sake of amassing scholarly work. There's a specific important reason for each of the things that I've done, trying to solve particular problems that I've encountered. And so the basic reason for doing all of these things is to find out what was the Buddha teaching. Because our faith, remember, is in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And Buddha is the one who's enlightened. Right? So it's not Sujata that you're going for refuge to. Okay? It's not Ajahn Brahm you're going for refuge to. It's not Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Mahabua you're going to refuge to. It's the Buddha. He is the teacher. All we can do is to try to understand his teachings, practice them, and then try to transmit them and share them as best we can. So everything which comes out of my mouth, which has a value and worth, is something which has come ultimately from the Buddha, and anything which comes from my own experience you should just take as being very little, very small, not as being of great importance. Okay? My main job here as a teacher is to try to articulate and clarify the Buddha's own words. That's actually the important thing that I'm here for. So the Dhamma that he taught, you know, we know the Buddha was not only enlightened in himself, but was able to articulate his experience very clearly and in a way which would lead to enlightenment. Notice that when it describes the Dhamma, it doesn't say the Dhamma is kind of perfect. You can't ever make words perfect. They always have some ambiguity and some problems with them. But it says that it's good enough to be able to realize it. Paccatang vedita bho vinyuhi. That by practicing it, you can realize it for yourself. And that's the test. And so the third object of refuge is the Sangha, is those who have practiced to realize this teaching. Okay, so in the Anagarika ceremony you did earlier, you took refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. We usually do in our evening chanting on the Wednesday nights. And Buddha Dhamma Sangha, going for refuge. That's what we're going for refuge to. The Buddha, the awakened one, the Dhamma, the teachings that he taught, and the truth that he realized, and the Sangha is those who practice to realize that. This is really in the highest sense what those refuges mean. It's very simple, it's very straightforward, there's nothing metaphysical or abstract about it. If we are staying here in this monastery, staying here together as a community, all the people here are capable of becoming enlightened in this rains retreat. Do not come to me with bullshit stories about your past karma stopping you from being able to get enlightened or meditate or anything like this. I don't believe you. I know all of you people. I know what you're capable of. You are capable of practicing and realizing enlightenment. I would not be here if I didn't believe that. I would not be here if I didn't believe that samsara was suffering, and that by practicing the Eightfold Path we can find a way out of suffering. If I really didn't believe that, I would probably go back and lie on a beach on Byron Bay and play the guitar. And I'd just become a grisly old revolting hippie. But I really believe that. I really believe that by practicing here in the forest tradition, in the forest, in this place, by practicing in this way, doing these meditations, the metta meditation, the anapanasati meditation, the contemplation of impermanence, contemplation of the body, doing these meditations in this context, in the Eightfold Path, that will actually lead to enlightenment. The only thing that's stopping us from getting enlightened here is our own ignorance, our own defilement. Don't let that stop us. Don't let the flame and the energy and the faith that you have become dimmed and become dissipated. I'm talking about the reality now. I'm talking about what is actually real for everyone here. What is actually real is that you have a mind of awareness. What is actually real is that each person sitting in this cave right now is aware, is awake. Well, more or less awake. But anyway, I think you're all awake. Hopefully you're all awake. Okay? You have that mind of awareness, and that mind of awareness is the mind of awakening. It is not something different. Okay? This potential for awakening is just taking that same mind and practicing with it, developing it, training it. All we have to do. There's no secret. There's no mystical zoom zoom zooms. Okay? There's no, you don't have to take photos of lights disappearing on the side of cameras. And say, well, aren't these lights special? Aren't there lots of arahants around? Or we don't have to have lots of kind of psychic stories and all of these things. None of these things are Dhamma. These are just entertainment. The Dhamma is, take that mind of awakening which you possess right here and now, and develop that, enlarge it, enhance it, make it more and more clear, and then use it to realize the truth and to let go of all attachments. That is the Dhamma. And there is no one here who cannot do that. There is no one here who does not have the capacity to understand what I'm saying and to put it into practice. There is no one here who cannot realize the truth of the Dhamma through practicing it, through their own efforts. Okay, so that's what we're here for now, for these next 2 weeks of the retreat and for the following 3 months of the Rains retreat. So please don't forget that. If we put the best possible effort that we can, the best possible effort that we can, and so that we become a shining beacon of awakening. This is my vision for this monastery. This is what I want to achieve. And so let's all try to do this in the next period of time at the Rains retreat together. So this is my talk for you all this evening, and I offer this for your reflection.